This is Money Talking from WNYC. I'm Charlie Herman. More than a year and a half from the 2016 presidential election, and already two of the leading candidates, Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton, are raising millions of dollars. Bush reportedly held a fundraiser in New York this week, and the price of admission was $100,000 per ticket. For her part, Clinton wants to line up at least 30 supporters who will pledge $1 million each for her campaign. Well, Ben White is with Politico, and he reported about the Bush fundraiser. And Ben, I don't think it'll be very surprising if this presidential race goes down as the most expensive on record. But why are they raising these sums of monies this early on in the cycle?
For his part, what he's attempting to do is put together something like $50 million in a super PAC before he's announced for president. What he wants to do is put together this giant war chest to, A, scare off other potential candidates and emerge as sort of the dominant player in the Republican Party, and B, get down to retail politicking earlier than he might otherwise be able to.
But isn't there a little bit of a contradiction here that at the same time you have the candidates raising money from really the 1%, at the same time that they're campaigning to fight for the middle class and to address income inequality?
Yeah, it's a particular little problem for Bush at this point, who comes into this race, should he decide to run, which I think he will, seen as a legacy politician who's for Wall Street. His family has a long history on Wall Street. Their calculation is they're going to take a hit on that. He gave a speech in Detroit recently where he's talking about bringing economic opportunity to the middle class, to those who've been sort of marginalized in the economic recovery, deal with economic inequality. And then he turns around and goes to Wall Street and raises $100,000 a pop. They know that doesn't look particularly great. Their thought is it's so early in the process, people aren't going to pay that close attention to it. And the benefit of having all that money outweighs the sort of hypocritical perspective given by these big, giant, high-dollar fundraisers.
So maybe these are crocodile tears I'm crying, but for the wealthiest in this country, is there already a little bit of donor fatigue?
Yeah, there absolutely is. And I used to see it, I think, a little bit more on the Democratic side now with the Hillary Clinton money machine. Politico had a good story by Ken Vogel about the difficulties she's having in raising these 30 people with $1 million each, because they've given to the Clinton Foundation, they've given to previous Clinton campaigns, and they do get asked over and over now in the age of the super PAC to give these giant checks, as opposed to when they could get away with $10,000 to a political action committee. Now it's, can you give us $50,000, $100,000? And even for people who are super wealthy, that does get old after a while. And it'll be true for Bush, too. He'll get one bite at the apple now, where I think people will want to write these big checks because they're sort of excited about him. But when he comes back to them later in the cycle, it's going to be a lot harder to scare that money up.
Ben White is the chief economic correspondent for Politico. Ben, thank you very much.
Always a pleasure.
At the Grammy Awards this week, there were some surprise winners. British crooner and newcomer Sam Smith and longtime artist Beck took home some of the biggest awards. But looking at the winners, I was wondering, in a world where you and I stream music, often for free, who's actually making money these days? Last year, Nielsen reported that on-demand music listening rose 54% to record levels. And as more of us are using Spotify and Pandora, we're buying a lot less. CD sales and digital purchases both fell. To get some answers, I checked in with Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, and Alex White, CEO and co-founder of The Next Big Sound, which measures music consumption and purchases. And I started off by asking Alex about the state of the music industry.
It's a really fascinating time for the music business right now. And I say this every year for the last 5 years we've been in business, where when we started in 2009, MySpace was the biggest streaming music site. Facebook hadn't launched page likes. Twitter had a list of 15 bands that were on there. And Spotify was still a year or two away from launching in the U.S. So it's hard to believe that was only 5 years ago. We've seen dramatic shifts in consumption. Streaming is up across the board. The revenue models are all in flux.
I think one thing that Alex points out that's really interesting is that we're not going through one digital revolution, we're going through two. The first digital revolution was paid downloads, like buying a song from iTunes, replacing album purchases. And you saw these single purchases weren't just disentangling the album by allowing you to buy song by song, but they were also replacing physical album sales. But the second wave of the digital revolution has been streaming. YouTube and Spotify and RDO and subscription access to music over buying individual songs. And what you're seeing now is that streaming is beginning to kill digital purchases, which themselves were killing physical albums.
Well, let me play you one sample song here just to talk about. Clap along. Of course, that's Happy by Pharrell Williams. You know, there was a story that or a leaked email that there were 43 million streams on Pandora of that song. I think probably everybody has heard that song. And for that amount of play, he got paid a whopping $2,700 in royalties. I mean, if you can have that many listens and make that little money, how does anybody survive in this industry now?
So I think that there's always going to be instances where you see a massive discrepancy between awareness, engagement, and revenue. And I think on a case-by-case, service-by-service basis, there's always going to be royalty statements posted and reasons for musicians to be upset or happy with what's actually happening. In the case of Pharrell Williams, his song was the song of 2014 across every different channel that we track. So on terrestrial U.S. radio, it was one of the most played songs. It was one of the most streamed songs, one of the most viewed songs on YouTube. And I think that across the different revenue streams, while one might have been small, in aggregate, Pharrell Williams is doing A-OK.
Is part of what needs to happen that the labels need to change the royalty agreements, that the payment agreements that they have with the artists?
I think that we see this happening across a lot of elements of the media landscape. We talk about whether or not Amazon, for example, is good for books because it exposes us to infinity books for cheaper prices than we were used to maybe 10 or 20 years ago, inflation adjusted. I think a very similar thing is happening with music. And it's a funny time to be a consumer because on the one hand, it is the best time in the world to be a consumer, to pay $10 a month to listen to 35 million songs. Are you kidding me? On your phone, wherever you go, that is a magical thing. At the same time, the very thing that makes it magical, which is the price point of $10, also makes it not that economical to be a musician relying exclusively on streaming music to make all of your money.
Well, Derek, Alex, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Derek Thompson is a senior editor at The Atlantic, and Alex White is CEO and co-founder of The Next Big Sound. You can find our entire conversation at moneytalking.org. I'm Charlie Herman, and this is Money Talking from WNYC.